I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, how the regime of Russian dictator Vladimir Putin depends on kill squads and a corrupt legal system to hold on to power and silence his critics, including investigative reporters. Tonight on PBS Frontline, we get a chilling view of the world of the brave journalists and dissidents who have stood up to Putin. And later on The Source, President Trump's mass deportation efforts are kicking into gear, but in the dragnet against undocumented migrants, ICE is nabbing some with legal residency and some U.S. citizens. They're being detained, even deported. There are claims that these are Venezuelan gang members, but with little to no evidence. What does this mean for anyone in the country and the rule of law? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half hour, we're going to be hearing about President Trump's use of the Enemy Aliens Act and ignoring due process for his mass deportations. But first, Russian dictator Vladimir Putin uses brute force, a corrupt legal system, and trained teams of assassins to maintain his grip on power. These assassins will surveil, abduct, drug, fatally poison, and more to keep Putin's critics silent. These are journalists and political opponents, dissidents, and they're putting their lives on the line to stand up to the tyranny and terror of the Putin regime. Tonight, we get an opportunity to see what that is like with the airing of Antidote, which is the latest Frontline documentary on PBS. It airs at 9 o'clock tonight on KLRN in San Antonio. We're joined by the director and the producer of Antidote, James Jones. And welcome back to The Source, James.
Great to be with you.
So break down the title. It has multiple meanings. Explain the title, Antidote.
Yeah, so I guess when we started the project, it was supposed to be a kind of expose of Putin's poison program, the way he developed poisons, the way he targeted his opponents in Russia and around the world. And as the filmmaking process continued, it kind of morphed more into an ongoing story about the risks you take and the sacrifices you make in standing up to Putin, in exposing the truth about Russia. And I guess without putting too fine a point on it, the word and the title Antidote is a reference to the idea that some of these brave people, you know, can potentially combat the poison that is Putin inside Russia.
Right. To counter Putin, we need the bravery of people like the ones that you follow in your documentary. And they are incredible, the work that they do.
They are. And, there are really three main characters, one of whom is a whistleblower from inside the poison program who, you know, is by no means an uncomplicated hero. You know, he was at the heart of darkness working on Novichok, which poisoned, you know, political opponents like Alexei Navalny. But, you know, even for him, the risks he took of fleeing Russia and then having to extract his family, you know, you really saw what people go through in you know, doing the work they do. And obviously our main character is Christo Grozev, who pulled off some kind of extraordinary investigations working with Bellingcat, which really exposed Russian spies and assassins in a way no one else had done previously. But the problem with that is in exposing these spies, he made some enemies. And, you know, Vladimir Putin can't stand being humiliated or laughed at. And I think it was when Christo did the Navalny investigation and kind of mocked the failed assassins around the world, that was when Putin really saw Christo as a target himself.
Our phone lines are open. If you have a question, a comment about Vladimir Putin's teams of trained assassins, how they operate, and the brave people who are standing up to Putin, like Christo Grozev, call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So let's talk about these assassins and what they do and what they're capable of. There is a chilling scene in the documentary where Crystal reads, what are they, like text messages or some sort of, you know, electronic messaging, where they are talking about all the different ways that they would like to kill him. Each way is more bizarre and gruesome than the next. Everything is no longer abstract. It's very concrete. These are trained people who have the means. They have the ability. They have nothing to stop them, who are planning on killing him in horrible ways. That is absolutely mind-blowing that a person would read that and still be able to function. I mean, talk about that scene.
Yeah, so that scene was a kind of culmination of everything that had happened over the previous year or so. You know, I was with Christo in New York when he first got the warning from the FBI that he couldn't travel back home to Europe because there was effectively a kill team waiting for him. And, you know, when we first heard that, I think it just felt unreal. You know, it was just totally surreal, like something out of a movie. And it wasn't tangible. So I think he was kind of discombobulated. He was uprooted from his home and he was kind of isolated in an unfamiliar place. But I don't think at that stage he was really truly afraid. And then as time went by, you know, they arrested these six spies in London, and then the trial was, well, it, after about a year the trial took place and more evidence started to come out. But the police hadn't told Christo all the details of this plot. You know, he knew there was some plot to abduct him, there was some talk of killing him, but he hadn't seen most of the evidence. And so that moment in the back of a taxi in New York City was basically, I'd been in court and I transcribed these text messages between the different spies and the ringleader. When, you know, the main ringleader is based in Moscow. And I honestly think that was, you know, and some pretty bad stuff happened to Christo and his family members in the meantime. But I think that was the first time I saw Christo truly shaken and afraid. Because it was people, as you say, like plotting how to abduct him, plotting how to kill him in increasingly unpleasant ways. And, you know, some of that was bravado maybe, but these people broke into his house. They surveilled him sitting next to him on flights, you know, filmed him, filmed his family. And so that was really the moment when it just felt incredibly close to home. And, you know, thankfully those six spies were convicted at the Old Bailey in London, and they're due to be sentenced next week. But the problem is these spies weren't even the best trained ones. These were kind of guns for hire who were kind of low level criminals recruited by a kind of Bulgarian network. The problem is now that Russia finds it harder to send their trained assassins because people like Christo have done such a good job exposing them, they're relying on these kind of freelancers. And you know, the problem with that is it's very hard to assess the risk, because if any criminal willing to do something for $10,000 could be a threat, it's impossible to know where that threat might come from.
In the documentary, we see that there are U.S. intelligence sources sometimes feeding information to Christo about his, you know, his risk and what's happening. You mentioned that just now. Obviously, the U.S. has intercepts and they're able to get a lot of information. I don't know if that is that still happening now under the current Trump era?
I think there's still information being shared. I think the great unknown for someone like Christo, who's taken refuge really in America.
I mean, when you have Tulsi Gabbard running the intelligence service and you know that she is kind to Putin, what has that ended?
I think that the, you know, the kind of middle ranking intelligence operatives are still cooperating with, you know, Western agencies. But there's obviously going to be a doubt in the mind if you're a German intelligence agent or British, you know, if you're going to share stuff about Russia with organizations where, you know, the head of those organizations has a very questionable relationship with people in the Kremlin, you obviously think twice. I think probably these guys are smart enough to figure out ways to kind of
Off the books. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got to take a break here. We're going to come back in 1 minute, continue our conversation about Antidote, the new Frontline documentary. Airs tonight on PBS, KLRN in San Antonio at 9 o'clock. You can also watch it online afterwards as well. The Source continues right after this. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the next half hour, we're going to be talking about President Trump's saying he doesn't know if he has to enforce due process under the Constitution. What does that mean for mass deportations? But right now we're talking about Antidote, which is the latest documentary from Emmy Award-winning filmmaker James Jones. It's an expose about whistleblowers who are confronting Vladimir Putin's regime, and that delves into the lives of individuals who risk everything to reveal the Kremlin's covert and deadly operations. And the number is, if you got a question or comment, 833-877-8255. I mean, the documentary does at times feel like one of those spy movies, you know, where risks are around every corner and you don't know what's going to happen next. And there you were filming this in real time. I mean, how did that feel for you?
Yeah, I mean, it did feel like we were living in a spy movie at certain points. You know, we started this project knowing that the stakes were very high for the people involved. We took great kind of security precautions, you know, communicating with encrypted apps and using code words and being cut off from the rest of the office, not hooked up to the internet. All these kind of basic things, occasionally thinking we're being silly here, like no one cares what we're doing. And then Crystal got that warning, and then six people were arrested for spying and plotting to kill and abduct him in London, where we live and where, you know, where the production was taking place. And so that was chilling, you know, and it did feel very close to home. And the whole thing was just so surreal but unpredictable. You know, we really didn't know where it was going to end. And that is hard personally, but also hard in terms of filmmaking, because, you know, usually you have some idea where the story's going to end, and this just had like a life of its own. And, you know, even down to the trial, we had to wait a year for the trial to happen. And in that intervening period, one of our other characters, who'd been held in a Russian prison for years, was suddenly released in a prisoner swap. And so, you know, none of that we could have predicted at the beginning, that Christo would be, you know, the target of an assassination plot himself, or that our other central character would be released in a prisoner swap for someone who Christo got locked up in Germany. So it was, you know, stranger than fiction and very strange to be living through it.
I have to signal that, I mean, there's some irony here. We're talking about Putin, who is shutting down journalism that he doesn't like, while we're on a platform, public radio, that's being attacked by President Trump. And this documentary is going to be airing tonight on PBS, which is also being attacked by President Trump. He's attempting to defund it. Are there some, you know, can you look at what's happening in the United States, attacks on the media? Of course, it's not as severe. As far as I know, they're not tossing reporters off of rooftops yet. But you know, what are you seeing here? What similarities do you see?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Putin at the beginning of his first term showed just an instinctive hostility to a free press, you know, didn't like to be criticized, would accuse them of lying. And that escalated to him, you know, sending men in balaclavas to TV stations. And I don't think anyone knows that we're going to reach that extreme scenario, but I think you see with this regime in the White House that there is hostility to many journalists. And, you know, the latest manifestation of that is the funding of PBS and NPR. But I think it's hard for me to comment as an outsider,
sure.
But there are certainly worrying trends. If I was a journalist in America, I would feel insecure, and the institutions are being undermined deliberately.
What does it mean that Putin is now pretty much out publicly, although he has denied involvement in these killings, it is a thin veil. So is it pretty clear that this is Putin out and about publicly killing his opponents? And what does it mean that that is happening?
Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, because lots of people ask, why does he use poison? You know, why not just shoot people? Why not just run them over with a car?
Well, he does do that.
He does do that occasionally, but there's something about poison that appeals to him on a few levels, I think. One of them is that it's deniable. You know, the poison can be attributed to a heart attack or, you know, overdose of antidepressant or whatever, and it disappears from the system within kind of 48 hours. And that is Putin's, you know, MO. He likes kind of disinformation and deniability. But it's also terrifying. You know, if you're a Russian opposition figure, the thought that you would die such a horrific death at the hands of these nerve agents is frightening. And Putin loves that idea as well. And I think the third thing is probably cruelty. You know, there must be some part of him that enjoys the thought of his worst enemies suffering a kind of horrific fate. So I think we understand why he uses poison. It's also been part of the Russian government going back decades. You know, they've been working on these nerve agents from Soviet times. So they've had these poisons in their armory. In terms of whether Putin is personally involved, you know, we have in those messages that we were talking about earlier, the ringleader who's based in Moscow even says at one point, you know, I'm not even that bothered about Christo Grozev, but Putin really hates him. And, you know, we have evidence that shows this wasn't just a kind of freelancer in Moscow. This came directly from the FSB and from Putin. So, you know, if Putin is involved in targeting, you know, a high profile journalist like Christo, but not someone like Navalny, who's a major threat to him politically, you know, I think we have a sense that the scale of this operation is pretty wide.
So you also highlight the story of Vladimir Kara-Murza, the Russian opposition leader. He survived two poisoning attempts. So are they just not good at it? How does he survive two poisoning attempts?
Yeah, I think it is hard to get the dosage right. You know, I asked our whistleblower from the poison program about this, like, how do they get it wrong so many times? And he says it is a bit of trial and error. And it is sometimes hard to deliver enough poison without poisoning, you know, yourself. But also, sometimes it's okay for them to survive. You know, it's just enough for most people as a warning to poison you or your family members to come close to it. So it's a kind of psychological attack as well as a physical one. And I think the assumption with someone like Kara-Murza is if you poison him twice, he'll quieten down. You know, he'll stop coming back to Russia. He'll give up on it. He'll live, you know, he lives with his family in America. And he was the one who chose to keep going back to Russia and not give up on it. So I think in Kara-Murza's case, Putin underestimated who he was dealing with. And then perhaps when Kara-Murza did go back in early 2022, after the war had begun, maybe he underestimated how much Russia had changed with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. You know, Putin post that invasion had very little to lose publicly and showed a kind of brutality domestically that we hadn't seen before.
So there was that prisoner swap. Apparently, according to your reporting, Putin wanted to regain one of his top assassins, Klaskov. And having to get his top assassin is important for his ability to maintain these assassin squads. So why give him up? Talk about that exchange and Biden's involvement.
Yeah, so the prisoner swap happened. A number of Russian political prisoners, as well as the Americans, Evan Gershkovich and Paul Whelan, were released in exchange for killers and spies. And the person that Putin wanted the most was Vadim Krasikov, who was known as the Berlin bicycle killer, who had a technique of basically shooting people from a moving bicycle. And he did that in Berlin in a park in broad daylight. And was arrested, thanks partly, and arrested and identified thanks partly to Christo's work. He was traveling under a fake passport, posing just as a regular Russian tourist. But he had a long-standing affiliation with the FSB and with Putin. And so Putin works like a mafia boss. You know, if you go and do a job for him, he needs to help you. He needs to get you back. And he needs to send a message to other assassins doing risky jobs that he's not going to abandon you. So for him, Krasikov was top of that list. The other spies are also important, partly because all of them not only, you know, were loyal servants of Putin, but also probably have information he would rather they didn't share. So a lot of killers and spies were swapped for these political opponents. And, you know, the kind of irony was that Christo had been involved in exposing the poisoners of Karamurza. He'd also played this integral part in getting Krasikov locked up. And he was actually, for the entire 2 years we were filming with him, he was working on this prisoner swap, partly because he wanted to free his friend Alexei Navalny, who was, you know, the most prominent opposition figure. And he'd been part of this planned prisoner swap until the very end, when he died or was more likely killed in Russian prison.
Right. People are familiar with Alexei Navalny in his stand trying to fight for democracy and anti-Putin dictatorship. And it was never clear to me until watching the documentary that he was murdered. I thought maybe he had just died from his previous poisonings.
Yeah, I mean, they're still piecing together exactly what happened, but there's certainly accounts from people within the prison that he displayed sudden symptoms of having been poisoned. You know, there's footage of him the day before when he seemed totally fine. And the timing, pretty much on the eve of this prisoner swap, is suspicious. And, you know, I never, even though I was hopeful a prisoner swap might happen, it never seemed plausible to me he would release Navalny because he genuinely was afraid of him.
Yeah, the people
And
really
so,
loved him in Russia.
well, loved him. He had a genuine popular following in a way that none of these other opposition figures do. And so he was, you know, typically Putin. He strung everyone along. He got Germany on board by promising Navalny, and then at the final moment had him killed, and then still months further down the line managed to get some form of the prisoner swap deal. So it's cynical and tragic. That he got what he wanted.
Christo Grozenev, what is he? So he's in the United States now. He's still working on his journalism and other efforts with all of his contacts and expertise. Does he do journalism training? I mean, he must know how to do so much. I don't know how he gets all the information that he has.
Yeah, certainly when he was at Bellingcat, which was their kind of open source investigative outfit. They did training to show people how you use publicly available data, imagery on social media or on YouTube to, you know, geolocate to solve crimes, basically. But in a, you know, in a responsible, grounded, factually grounded way. Christo's probably doing less of that now that he's gone freelance. And Christo, his specialism really is kind of in the Russian, you know, kind of grey world, or whatever you call it, where basically in Russia, a lot of this data is for sale effectively. And so he has travel records, passport records, and he can, you know, he has not only encyclopedic knowledge of this stuff, but just spreadsheet after spreadsheet where he can cross-check names and spot patterns and see that, oh, well, this certain run of passport numbers are all consecutive. That means they must all have been issued by the same FSB office. So he can solve crimes with data that to most people would just look like, you know, numbers and
Well, that's an
kind of
amazing expertise. I'd love
dates.
to learn some of that. The documentary has ends with a sort of a dark, optimistic tone that the Putin's regime will fall eventually, hopefully to be replaced by democracy, but still, we're not there.
Yeah, I mean, Christo is more optimistic than I am about that. I think, you know, it's not just Putin that there's something quite rotten in Russia going, you know, down the system. I also think, whereas 6 months ago, a year ago, the war was going badly for Putin. The sanctions were beginning to bite. Now he has his best friend in the White House. I think a lot of that pressure is eased, and I don't think there's any reason to think he's going anywhere anytime soon.
Antidote airs tonight on PBS. It also premiere on PBS Frontline's YouTube channel and the PBS Documentaries Prime video channel as well. James Jones, thank you so much for talking to us. Great reporting. Antidote is wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks so much.